This is WGTD. You are listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Falkowski, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. As the world opens up again this summer, it's a great time to highlight local institutions, and one of the great gems of living in and visiting Kenosha are our public museums, and yes, that is plural, because we have several distinct offerings unique to a community of this size. We're going to hear more about them and all of the summer and fall programming that they have in mind for us and from today's guests. Our guests from the Kenosha Public Museums are Doug Damon, who serves as educational coordinator for the Kenosha Museum campus, which includes the Kenosha Public Museum, the Civil War Museum, the Dinosaur Discovery Museum. He's been with the Kenosha Museum campus for 13 years. Thanks for joining us, Doug.
Sure, no problem, Karen. Thanks for having us.
And I should have asked about pronouncing your last names. Did I do that okay? Was it Doug Damon?
Damon, yeah, close Damon. Enough. You were close. So.
Okay.
That's a win.
And so Nick, forgive me. So the next guest is Nick. Is it Wearsome?
Yep.
Great, okay. He is the curator of natural science education at the Kenosha Public Museums. And is the host of the weekly preschool program, Museum Munchkins, which we're going to hear more about later, too. So welcome to both of you. Tell us the status of our museums. I know a lot of people have just kind of been hunkered down for a year, and now they're starting to come out. But it sounds like you actually have been open for a while. So tell us when you reopened, and what have you been able to resume, and has it changed at all?
Well, Karen, I'll start off, and then Nick, maybe you can fill in some of the gaps. We, of course, like the rest of the world, pretty much we closed last March 16th. I can remember I worked Sunday, March 15th was our last day that we were open to the public. We closed for a bit of time, but reopened on a limited basis last summer. So the museum has been open and operational now for over a year since we've been within the pandemic. But on a limited amount of time, a limited schedule, and with limited capacities within each of the three buildings. So we obviously took steps, cleaning steps and social distancing efforts, sanitizing efforts, and then had to really curtail much of our public programs and some of our school group programs and other things to stay safe, really, to keep the staff and our visitors safe. But we are open for visitation currently. For this, through the end of this week, we've been open Tuesday through Saturdays, 10 to 4:30. But after the 4th of July, starting July 6th, all three museums return to our normal operating schedule, which is at the Public Museum and the Civil War Museum. We're a 7-day-a-week operation from 10 to 5, and then the Dinosaur Museum is closed on Mondays, and they're 12 to 5. So we're getting back to normal right after the 4th of July holiday.
Yeah, and some of our visitors who have been coming back since last summer noticed that when we reopened, we did so with, like Doug said, some limitations. A lot of our interactives and the exhibits had to be removed. And some of those are going to start coming back too after the 6th. But we've also got some changes that visitors will notice. The lower level at the Dinosaur Discovery Museum, all the activities we have down there are still being put away just for people's safety. Although you can still visit the Carthage Institute of Paleontology lab that's downstairs. And at the Public Museum, our children's space, the field station, is currently undergoing a renovation. So visitors will be able to look forward to visiting with us again and enjoying that space come this fall.
Great. Okay. So this is timely. So I'm not sure exactly when people will be hearing it, but it will be after July 5th. So your hours have returned to normal, and that's great news. Okay. So let's just back up a little bit. There may be listeners who haven't visited the museums for a while, or maybe didn't even know we had three different ones, depending on where they're listening from. So please, if you could each take some turns describing each one and its location, collections, and some of the specific programs.
Sure. Well, Nick, why don't we lead off with the public museum? That's really the flagship, I think, of all three, the Kenosha Public Museum. It has the longest tenure here in Kenosha. I believe it's approaching its 85th anniversary here within the community. And for the past 20 years, Nick mentioned our field station, our hands-on interactive area at the Public Museum undergoing renovation. Our goal is to have the field station open the week after Labor Day, which coincides with the 20th anniversary of the Kenosha Public Museum moving from its former location on 10th Avenue, where the Dinosaur Discovery Museum is now, to its lakefront location. And so it's almost like we have two anniversaries for the Kenosha Public Museum, the overall anniversary, but then also the updated one, the move to Harbor Park in 2001. So we're really looking forward to celebrating that anniversary in September with the kind of re-grand opening and the re-emergence of our field station hands-on family activity area. The Kenosha Public Museum, its mission and really its focus when it comes to our collection is art and natural history, as well as an intense study into the Native American tribes that lived in southeastern Wisconsin and still live here, still call this area home. So Nick, fill in the gaps. What did I forget about the public museum?
Yeah, no, that's pretty good. We have, like Doug said, our primary focus there is at the public museum is art, anthropology, and natural sciences. And our first floor exhibit sort of talks about the history of Kenosha, going back about 400 million years to the late Silurian period, and talking about the ancient tropical reefs that used to cover Kenosha, going through the Ice Age and talking about the mammoths that have been discovered here in Kenosha, and then ending up in the fur trading era, and like Doug said, talking about the Native American populations and their role during that period, and we're hoping to expand on, like Doug said, they're still very active in the area, still living here, and hoping to expand on that in the future. And then upstairs we have, which is only a couple years old now, our From Curiosity to Science exhibit, which opened in March of 2019. And that exhibit talks about sort of where museums came from cabinets of curiosities that people built in their houses and had their friends come visit and check out all their cool collections of things that they've gotten from around the world, and how museums evolve from that. And then it goes into sort of Kenosha, talking about Kenosha as a local environment, a local ecosystem that's very diverse, and how we can explore that diversity through global ecosystems as well. So we take a look at six different ecosystems from around the world, water, Arctic ecosystems, grasslands, forests, wetlands, and sort of tie them into the local ecosystems we find here around Kenosha County. And that's a great place when people are looking for the animals at our museum. That's the great place where they can find animals from all over the world. And then currently right now we have the Transparent Color Watercolor Society of America's annual juried exhibition up on the second floor as well, which is where we're so fortunate to have that exhibit with us every year. And it's a great show. People should stop in and check it out.
I've been to that show a few times over the years, and I have to say it is really stunning. If you are a person who just really enjoys visual art, you need to go in and and take a look at those beautiful watercolors. I mean, it's just kind of amazing. Sometimes you can't even believe those are paintings. They're so, so amazing. So do you still have that area where you have a live working artist occasionally? Is that still in place?
The artist workshop, we actually did get rid of that. Mm-hmm. To expand our gallery space on the second floor when we were doing the renovations for Curiosity to Science. So when those renovations went through a few years ago, we did get rid of the artist space to work. But
the good news is you actually have one of the things that I think is really unique about our museum campus is that it's right there in the Harbor Park, which is also where our beautiful award-winning farmers market is. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of artists on display there. So sometimes they're even working while they're displaying their work. So you can sometimes see it there.
Absolutely.
So that's the main campus museum, the Kenosha Public Museum. So the Civil War Museum is often, sometimes people think that's a really unusual thing, that we would have a Civil War Museum in Wisconsin. So tell the audience a little bit about the Civil War Museum, the kinds of exhibits that you have there, and how did it come to Kenosha, of all places?
That's not an uncommon reaction when people learn about the project for the first time, because I think people equate Civil War importance to the battlefield. You know, if you don't have Gettysburg, if you don't have Antietam, if you're not next to Vicksburg, well, in many people's minds, it equates to, well, how much could the Civil War have impacted a community that wasn't right next door to one of those major battlefields? And granted, yes, there aren't really any major battlefields in the seven states of the upper Midwest, which is the focus really of the Civil War Museum. We don't just concentrate on local Kenosha history as it relates to that time period, or even Wisconsin history as it relates to the Civil War. The scope is wider, it's much broader, to encompass the seven states of the upper Midwest, from Ohio all the way westward to Iowa and Minnesota. And so it's a very broad story about how this time period, how the Civil War impacted people who lived in those communities and in those young states that were emerging at that time. And, you know, the impact of the Civil War wasn't just on those individuals who decided to serve in the Union Army or Navy or in the Marine Corps. Certainly, when you talk about this number of soldiers that came out of the upper Midwest, if you add those seven states together, which is the focus of the museum, the number of soldiers equals over a million, almost 1.1 million soldiers, which was about 48% of the Union Army. So, you know, one out of every two soldiers that served in Mr. Lincoln's Union Army came from the upper Midwestern states. So the states provided a huge number of soldiers and a large amount of manpower to the fighting force. But the state also supplied natural resources in the form of iron and copper, timber, galena lead, all of the things that made the war effort possible. Those raw materials were made into the objects and things that the soldiers needed to fight the war. And then largely the amount of food that they ate was either raised or grown here in the upper Midwest and then sent to the front. And so granted, while Kenosha and while Wisconsin and the seven states of the upper Midwest does not have that large battlefield that's connected to it, we were certainly important in terms of manpower, natural resources, and food production. And so when people come to the museum, that's the story they learn, the impact that this 4 years of war had on their daily lives and on their community and on their state and on their families. And so it's not not really a military story at all. It's more of a social history story and impact of the issues that led to war and the impact on this local environment.
Okay. So what are some sort of can't miss things that people often comment about the Civil War Museum?
Well, I think the number one thing is the 360-degree movie presentation called Seeing the Elephant. It airs every hour on the hour, and it's about a 12-minute film entitled Seeing the Elephant that really gives people a sense of the motivation. What sent these individuals off to war? Why did they leave home? What was in it for them? And then how did these motivations change once the reality of their service kicked in? What was it like to be a soldier? What was it like to train? And then ultimately, what was it like when they experienced their first time in actual combat? How did it change their attitudes about war? How did it maybe blow up some of those misconceptions that they brought with them from home about what this experience was going to be like? And so people stand on a raised platform in the middle of that gallery, and the screen for the film literally envelops you. It's a full 360 degree experience, which is very unique in the United States and really in the world. And so that to me is the big takeaway for most people when they come. If you ask, I think, what was most memorable about their visit, I think that would certainly be high on the list.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. It is pretty amazing. I do think for a lot of people and maybe even older visitors, the sort of village setup where they can kind of walk through the streets of nothing that any living person would have experienced, but probably some of the pictures they remember seeing, or some towns maintained that look for a while. But yeah, I think there's definitely a lot to see. And I think it's good that you highlighted that it's really not necessarily about military history so much as it's about daily life. And I think for a lot of people, it's very interesting for that reason.
It's an interesting comment you make, Karen, about the environment in which the exhibits are placed. What we wanted to do is make it an immersive experience. And so you're exactly right. When we're exhibiting artifacts that talk about maybe the pre-war experiences in the upper Midwest or the experiences of soldiers in camp, we place those objects, those artifact cases, the interpretation within the context in which they would have been used at the time. So it's not just a modern room with modern exhibit cases. What we tried to do is fit those cases into the built environment or the actual environment itself so that people are immersed in that physical and built environment as they study the exhibits and walk through. I think it's an effective technique.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guests. You are listening to WGTD-HDFM. And this is Education Matters. This discussion about the Kenosha Public Museums and their summer and fall 2021 programs is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So we're talking to Doug Dahmen and Nick Wiersum. So we have not yet discussed the Dinosaur Discovery Museum. So I don't know which of you prefers to talk about that, but I know it's very, very popular with the under 10 crowd and a lot of the over 10 crowd as well.
Absolutely. Dinosaurs are, no, it's not hard to get people excited about dinosaurs. So we actually have a really unique dinosaur museum here in Kenosha. So the Dinosaur Discovery Museum hosts the nation's largest display of meat-eating theropod dinosaurs, which is really, like I said, it's really unique. We have 25 different species on display, all in one large gallery space on the upper floor of the museum. And the reason we have so many of this one type of dinosaur there is because the museum is set there to talk about a specific story, which is that the dinosaurs are not gone. 65.5 million years ago, an asteroid slammed into our planet and killed off dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus Rex and Triceratops. But there are 10,000 species of dinosaurs that still live on our planet today. We just call them birds. So our museum is set up to talk all about that connection between theropod dinosaurs like T-Rex and Velociraptor and their modern day descendants, the birds. So we have a mixture of avian and non-avian dinosaurs on display at the museum. We've also got in the lobby a small exhibit talking about little Clint, who is a baby Tyrannosaurus Rex, who was found by the Carthage Institute of Paleontology on their field seasons We talk a little bit about, you know, how the world was different when little Clint was around, how little Clint's body would have changed as he got older, and you know, what those changes would have looked like. We talk about how he was excavated and studied in a lab, and then how we decide, you know, what goes on display in a museum. So we really sort of try to tell the whole story of little Clint from him being alive all the way to him making his way to the museum. And really to highlight that when we find a lot of dinosaur specimens, we find bits and pieces. We don't find complete skeletons. And little Clint is a great example of that. We only have a handful of bones from his skeleton. So, and then downstairs in the lower level, the connection with Carthage continues. That's where we find the Carthage Institute of Paleontology lab. Outside the lab, there are several cases that show some of the different types of specimens that they collect on their annual field season, whether it be fish or turtles or crocodilians or dinosaurs. We have all those sorts of fossils on display. And then there's the lab with these big, large windows. You can look into the lab and watch both staff and students working on the fossils there in the lab. In normal times, we also do have children's exhibits or children's activities downstairs. But those are currently put away right now just for safety and for sanitation efforts. Same thing goes with the Little Clint exhibit upstairs. There are several hands-on activities that will be back out starting after July 6th. The larger element, like our excavation dig site, will still remain closed for right now.
Right. So we're hoping those will come back at some point. But right now, there's still plenty to see and do, absolutely, even without doing that. So yes, for people who have never been to the Dinosaur Discovery Museum, you're in for a big surprise. It seems, and tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, this seems like an unusually broad array of offerings for a community of only 100,000 people. Am I correct about that?
It's pretty unique.
Yeah, I would agree that the commitment that the city has made to the museums, the buildings themselves are world-class facilities, really, I can say that. They're not only the exhibit areas that are front and center that the public see, but also the back of the house. So much of museum work goes on behind the scenes to care for that collection. I mean, what makes a museum unique and within the education community really is we have a mission, but then we also collect items to support that mission, and then just collecting them and hoarding them isn't enough. You have to interpret them. You have to use them to teach people. So that's, you know, the biggest teaching tool we have are our exhibits downstairs, our most visible ones. But there's also a tremendous amount of the collection that is also stored in the museums for long-term safekeeping, because museums have to look and think long-term. We have to collect and preserve these items 50, 100, 150 years into the future. And so that goes into our everyday decision-making about what sort of things are on display, how long they can be on display, what's the best environment for them to be housed in. And so really these facilities here in Kenosha are amazing resources to not only display those objects, but also preserve them and study them, as Nick described, with the Carthage Institute of Paleontology and the Dinosaur Discovery Museum. Mm-hmm.
So part of the mission of the museums is to preserve and protect our heritage, but also to teach people. And I'm going to ask a few more questions about school age visits later, but I did want to note that Nick said something about museum munchkins when he sent his bio over. So Nick, please describe the museum munchkins so that our listeners might be able to take advantage.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So Museum Munchkins is a weekly preschool program that we run focused on natural science. It sort of started as an excuse to get some of the really interesting animals that we have in our collection that weren't on display out so visitors could see them and experience them. You know, like Doug said, we have a really large collection. I think there's over 100,000 artifacts and specimens in the museum's collection. And just a small fragment of that is on display. So we really wanted to not only get those specimens out so people could see them and enjoy them, but also so we could teach families about them and really foster a sense of curiosity and stewardship for nature in our younger visitors. So Museum Munchkins was born out of that idea. Like I said, it's a weekly preschool program where we talk about a different theme every week, and we sing songs and read stories and talk about animals and get up close with specimens from the collection as often as we can. There are also hands-on elements. And then we also do crafts and activities along with whatever the theme is for that week. So,
Nick's being a little modest, Karen. Nick plays guitar. He's really the driving force behind Museum Munchkins. And oftentimes, you know, whatever the featured animal is or specimen for that week, Nick will create a parody song from a popular song that kids will know. He gets them up and moving around. There's just a lot of activity, a lot of energy, and just a lot of fun and learning that's going on for these preschool-aged students. And I think as an observer of this program over the years, what's really neat to see is our Munchkins graduate, so to speak, every year. They graduate to kindergarten, they graduate to elementary school, and then you see some of these graduate students coming back with younger siblings to take in Museum Munchkins with their families again. And, you know, it's multi-generational. You see grandparents with grandkids. It's just a lot of fun, and it's one of our real gems, I think, of what we offer at the Public Museum. It's Wednesday mornings at 9:30. So we're really excited. Nick did the first live in-person Munchkins program in almost a year and a half last Wednesday. And when I walked by, everybody was singing and dancing and getting up close and personal with Mr. Nick, having a great time studying alligators. Nick, wasn't it alligators last
week? Yeah, we talked all about alligators. So,
wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a program. I do tend to be a little modest about it, but it's also a program. Yeah, that we've presented about at the National Science Teachers Association annual conference a couple times now. Just because of how successful it is. And we actually ended up turning it everything shut down last year, and we started offering all these new virtual programs too. We turned it into a virtual program that we could do with preschool classrooms then too. That's really been a fun experience too, to have schools then too reach out to us to do the program virtually with their institutions. So
that was my next line of questioning, was about, you know, sort of what you learned and what changed during the couple of months of shutdown period and the reopening. So are you going to continue to offer Museum Munchkins online, and are there recordings of it that people can watch too, or is it always live?
Well, luckily there are, you know, dozens of episodes that we have pre-recorded and are up on our YouTube and our social media that people can go in and watch and enjoy. As of right now, we don't have any plans to continue recording them and putting them up on social media. That's not to say that we wouldn't do that in the future, though. But right now, we're going to focus back on transitioning back to that live in-person audience. So we really want to encourage people, as they're feeling comfortable, to start coming back to the museum and enjoying those animals and enjoying that program with us in person and live.
Okay. Well, I'm going to find the YouTube link, though, and put it in our show notes and on the Facebook page. So if people are listening and they're curious, you'll be able to find that if you go to the internet later.
Yeah, it was a huge undertaking, though. Last March, we realized that we had a full schedule of in-person school groups waiting to come in April, May, and June. Spring is always our busiest time here when it comes for school visits at all three buildings. And when those became unavailable, our team, our education team, knew that we had to do something to transition to the new reality of COVID and to transition more to a virtual platform, which we did with not only all of our public programs that we offer, like Munchkins, like our Second Friday lectures at the Civil War Museum, and to our workshops as well. We had to pivot to a virtual platform, but we also created 17 virtual programs, school group programs, that we delivered to schools, not only locally, but literally all over the country. That those school group programs took what I think, what we offered and what we did best at each of the three museums and what we offered to school groups and to students. And to the best of our ability, we morphed them into a virtual experience. Now, I personally feel like one of the most powerful things you can do at a museum is you get up close and with the objects, right? That's, you come in and you experience Stan the T-Rex, or you see the Schaefer Mammoth, or you see the 360-degree film. Nothing can replace that on-site visit. But our challenge as an education department and as a team was to stay relevant and in the public eye and still be offering these opportunities to school groups. And so I really commend the educators that work here. We were able to take those ideas and create virtual visits based around natural history and the Potawatomi and Civil War and art, and offer those to school groups, preschool groups, college age groups, adult groups as well. So we were able to stay relevant and stay out there and contributing to virtual learning as we were able to pivot. And right. Karen, I guess the one last thing I'll say about it is we were no longer limited by geography. And so the one positive to come out of this pandemic was we were able to interact with students in groups that probably wouldn't, because of the cost of busing or the physical time that it would have taken for them to come to Kenosha, we were able to teach and interact with them virtually. And so there was a silver lining in all of this. And for me, that was the biggest one.
Right. And I have heard this from a lot of people about how they were able to explore museums that they would never physically be able to travel to. And since this is such a unique, especially the Civil War Museum and the Dinosaur Museum, very, very unique collection, I think that was probably, again, a silver lining. Let me just reintroduce. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion about the Kenosha Public Museums and their summer and fall 2021 programs is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. And also, I collect the links to the things we've discussed here on both the archived page and on the Facebook page. So if you heard something you want to explore a little bit more, please go there. So I guess when you were shut down for the pandemic, you weren't really shut down. You were all working. Were there some things that you couldn't do at home? Did you come into the office, or how did that work?
No, we were all working from home until right around this time last year, around post 4th of July, we were able to come back into the building. As a manager of the department, that was, you know, a very challenging aspect. I can remember April of May of 2020, what's a Zoom call? How do we interact with this? I think some of my staff probably laughed a little bit. They had a little more experience with doing these types of, you know, virtual meetings and things. But yeah, the big challenge I think for all of us was communication, staying together, supporting one another while we were working from home. And then also working creatively, collaboratively together to come up with these ideas, to create those virtual programs, to keep the things moving forward, and to realize what was possible. So for me personally, the biggest challenge was just learning the technology, and then understanding how we could best communicate as a team in that environment.
Mm-hmm. So what is some like secret or weird thing that the general public would never think of as a challenge of running the museum during the pandemic?
Oh gosh, that's a good question.
Good question. For me personally, one of the, and this kind of spans into another aspect of the Civil War Museum in which I work closely on, we created a new exhibit, largely separate from one another. We debuted a new exhibit last winter in January about the immigrant experience serving in the Union Army. Now, by the end of the war, one out of every four Union soldiers was not born in the United States. They were born in other parts of the world and had immigrated to the U.S. and ended up serving with the Union Army. And so collaboratively, we were trying to do the research and find images and write the exhibit from afar. And so that's often difficult to do when you don't have the three-dimensional objects right in front of you to inspire you and to know what you're working with. So that was a huge learning curve and a huge undertaking by our museum to put that exhibit together, largely while we were working not in the museum.
Yeah, and I mean, and for me, I think the biggest, you know, as an educator, you know, being in the classroom or being in the museum with people and talking about things and feeding off each other's energy and, you know, getting those instant reactions from kids as we're talking about different specimens or different animals or whatever it is that we're discussing is such a big part of our job and part of the reason we love educating. And then in the pandemic, everything went virtual. Like we talked about, the Munchkins program turned into me trying to deliver that same amount of energy to no one in a room by myself and our social media coordinator, just sitting and filming this, you know, talking. I felt a little bit like, you know, when you see these children's shows where there's a live performer interacting with a CGI person who isn't there, or CGI characters not there, talking to these kids who aren't there. And same thing with our school groups. It's, you know, a lot of times the kids are at home too, and their cameras are off or their cameras are on, but they're muted. And so they're not talking to you, and it's just you silently presenting this program to a bunch of screens. That was, I think, the biggest one of the biggest learning curves for me, and switching everything over to virtual was not getting that feedback, direct feedback from students in the room with us.
Yeah, I would say every single teacher on the planet agrees with you.
Yeah,
that was a rough adjustment for all of us. What do you see happening in the fall? I know you probably run teacher workshops normally in the summer. Is that work going on now? And what do you see happening in the fall and next year for school visits? And are you going to continue the virtual school visits? Or
yeah, I think that what the pandemic is really allowing us to do is we will be having in-person school visits here back at the museum. Right now, we're still working under a limited capacity, so maybe not to the physical size of some of the groups currently. You know, as things continue to progress, we may be able to go back to the sizes that we had done in the past. But what I'm really looking forward to is not only, like Nick said, getting those groups back into the building and having those in-person experiences with them, but also taking the best of what we did virtually and still offering those. I still think there's a huge market for those and really a need. And it allows us to communicate and interact with student groups, like I said earlier, that we probably wouldn't have been able to simply because of geography or the cost of busing or pulling the students out of a school for the entire day. You know, now we can pull them out maybe for just and interact with them during that particular classroom portion or that period of the day when they would have U.S. history or be studying the Civil War. Now we can interact with them during that class period and still have that opportunity. So I look forward to combining the best of what we have virtually with our outstanding on-site programs and in-person programs.
I know in the past you would lend out objects or trunks with objects or boxes or things like that. Is that something you can't do right now?
Yeah, we largely had to trim that back. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that we did do, we have a program here at the Civil War Museum called You Are the Soldier, which introduces students to the uniform and equipment that a Union soldier would have carried with them, and also allows students to make choices, because everything that a soldier would have carried would have gone into a knapsack, which isn't that much different than a backpack that the kids would take to school every day. And, you know, if you're, we challenge them to think about, imagine if you had to take everything in your backpack for a 3 to 6 month camping trip, that you had to put everything in there as far as what you, a change of clothes, everything for personal hygiene, everything that you would need to prepare a meal, and then everything that you might need to entertain yourself for 3 to 6 months. Not only does it go in the backpack, but you're the one that's largely responsible for carrying that backpack. So that introduces those concepts to the students. What we've been able to do is to put together a trunk that if a school wants to do that program virtually, what I can do is we can send that trunk to the school. So as we're doing it in the virtual world, I can say, all right, let's take out this item from the trunk, and you can see it up close and personal rather than just experiencing it through the computer screen. Mm. Because when that program goes on here at the museum, it's like Nick said, you get that interaction. You know what's working instantly. You know where you see the eyes of the students. You see them kind of perk up in their chairs, and you know, okay, this is what they're interested in this. Let's continue down this path. And so that particular trunk has allowed us to still provide that type of interaction.
Great. So we have just a minute or so left. What I want to say is, aside from coming to Museum Munchkins on Wednesday morning, or possibly stopping over to make a quick visit while using the restroom during the farmers market on Saturday, I want each of you to invite the public that's listening right now to something that's happening in the next couple of months in the museum. So what would you really like to highlight for our listeners?
Oh, gosh. Well, coming up in just a couple weeks on July 19th, we are doing a virtual dinosaur family night, which has been a really popular program. We've offered several of them over the last year, where visitors can log on from the comfort of their homes and learn more about dinosaurs, not only that we have in the exhibits, but then this one's coming up. We actually will be focusing specifically on animals or dinosaurs that we don't feature at the museum, the plant-eating dinosaurs. And then coming up on Saturday, August 21st, if you're interested in doing some fossil hunting of your own, we will be going down, we're running a lakeshore fossil hunting workshop for families that we're going to meet at the public museum. And then we're going to head actually down to the Kenosha Lakeshore and learn about the fossils that we can collect there and then do some collecting of our own.
Wow. Okay.
And Karen, for me, our summer camp program, that's going to kick off here in just a few weeks. I'm really excited about summer camps this year, simply because I didn't think, if you'd have asked me maybe 3-4 months ago, are we going to be able to have in-person summer camps at the public museum, which is always a huge highlight every summer, my answer probably would have been no. But we were able to do it. Our team is able to come up with a way to do it safely. We have a little bit of a limited capacity this year. We're running each camp at about 50% of what we normally would do. But we have summer camp offerings for two age groups, students ages 5 to 6, and then students 7 to 10, in a variety of different themes. A dinosaur themed, we have anthropology, we have an art themed camp, and I'm really excited to welcome the campers back to the public museum starting after the 4th of July.
Well, that's thrilling. So I just want to let the listeners know that I'm going to collect all these links. I'll put them up on the archived page and on the Facebook page in case you don't want to search for them yourselves. But I want to thank my guest, Doug Dahman, the educational coordinator for the Kenosha Museum campus, and Nick Worsam, the curator of natural science education at Kenosha Public Museum.